You don't mind, open your Bibles to 1 Timothy chapter 5. 1 Timothy chapter 5. The evidence continues to show that we have an aging population. At the year 2000, there were 10 times as many people 65 and older as there were at the year 1900. It is estimated at the year 2030 that there will be twice as many people 65 and older as there were in the late 90s. That is only going to increase in the near days because you've got the baby boomer generation, which will start turning 65 in about 3 years. With that increase in age, an increase of an aging population, it's going to have an impact on all of society, and it's going to have an impact on the family and even on the church. I think by and large that's going to be a very positive impact as we have experience and maturity to guide us into the future. But there are also going to be some struggles to work with that go along with that. In addition to an aging population, we have a population that's living longer. People come today, have an approximate estimation of almost 80 years. And it won't be long until the official estimates arrive at 80 years. It is going to become, unless there are major changes, more and more common to see people in their late 90s, people living to be 100. As we think about those things, I want us to keep those in the back of our mind in today's world as we step back into Paul's world, a time in which 60 years of age was very, very old, because most folks didn't live much beyond that in New Testament times. I would like you to follow along with me as we read from 1 Timothy chapter 5 in the first 16 verses. It says, "Do not sharply rebuke an older man, but rather appeal to him as to a father and younger men as brothers, the older women as mothers and the younger women as sisters in all purity. Honor widows who are widows indeed. But if any widow has children or grandchildren, they must first learn to practice piety in regard to their own family and to make some return to their parents, for this is acceptable in the sight of God. Now she who is a widow indeed and who has been left alone has fixed her hope in God and continues in entreaties and prayers night and day, but she who gives herself to want and pleasure is dead even while she lives. Prescribe these things as well, so that they may be above reproach. But if anyone does not provide for his own, and especially for those of his own household, he has denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. A widow is to be put on the list only if she is not less than 60 years of age, having been the wife of one man, having a reputation for good works, and if she have brought up children, if she has shown hospitality to strangers, if she has washed the saints' feet, if she has assisted those in distress, and if she has devoted herself to every good work. But refuse to put younger widows on the list, for they will feel sensual desires in disregard to Christ. They want to get married, thus incurring condemnation because they have set aside their previous pledge. At the same time, they also learn to be idle as they go around from house to house, and not merely idle, but also gossips and busybodies, talking about things not proper to mention. Therefore, I want younger widows to get married, to bear children, to keep house, and give the enemy no occasion for reproach. For some have already turned aside to follow Satan. And if any woman who is a believer has dependent widows, she must assist them, and the church must not be burdened, so that it may assist those who are widows indeed." Now, I just want to hit a few highlights as time permits as we walk through this passage. I'm going to use the letter R as our memory glue. First of all, I just want us to look at a general principle that Paul lays down as he begins the whole chapter, and that is you respect age. Now, he's also going to talk about those who are contemporaries in age, both men and women. But he's going to especially talk about men and women who are older. He's going to start with them before moving to those who are younger. Remember that in chapter 4, in verses 11 through 16, we spent a couple of weeks focusing on those verses because they talk about the work and lifestyle of a minister. And Timothy is a minister of God whose responsibility is to teach God's people God's Word. That is going to include sometimes having to deal with some problems, and at times that would have to include correction. Remember that right at the end of chapter 4, he says, "Pay close attention to yourself and to your doctrine," or your teaching, "for in so doing you will save yourself and those who hear you." Well, doing that, paying attention to what we say and what we teach and carrying out the responsibilities of ministry, it may involve things along the line of what we talked about this morning. Remember, we talked about this morning that as a part of our relationship with each other, there will be times when we need to confront each other. There will be times when we need to go to each other and say, you know, "You're not living a lifestyle right with God, or I'm afraid your soul is in jeopardy, and I'm worried about you, I'm praying for you, and you need to make some changes." Timothy was going to have to do that from time to time. And because of his position, there would be times when he might have to do that with somebody who was older than him. But he says, on those occasions when you have to confront somebody who's older than you about their sin, he said, treat them like you would your own father. Treat the older ladies like you would your own mother. And he says, even with your dealings with folks that are close to your age, treat them like you would a brother or a sister. You know, I think about my brother and my sisters, and growing up, you know, we had our fights and we had our squabbles, but man, nobody else better mess with them. Okay, somebody messes with my three sisters or my brother, I'm going to be there to defend them because we're family. And family sticks together. Yes, there'll be times when family struggles with each other, but families who act in a godly way are going to forgive each other, who are going to help each other when the chips are down. And he says, so even when you've got a disagreement with folks your own age, respond like you would in a family and treat them like you would your own parents. And so I just think that's a general principle that overlays everything else in the chapter and really just is a general principle for life. Again, over and over, Paul emphasizes this idea that we are a family. And so he keeps hammering on that over and over and over. And so whether we're dealing with somebody close to our age or somebody older than us, then we act and treat each other like family. So Paul begins there. Then he starts talking about return. He goes from saying treat each other like family to saying how families should actually treat each other. And he begins talking about widows. There's a Dutch proverb that says it's easier for one poor farmer to raise 10 children than it seems to be for 10 rich children to take care of one poor farmer. I want you to think about that. Think of how many times that you've known a mom and dad that have raised a passel of kids only as they grew older and needed help to be left alone. And suddenly those 10 kids are scattered to the winds and suddenly don't have any time for a phone call, much less to take care of them in their hour of need. Paul says that should never, ever, ever be the case. He says that we are to honor widows who are widows indeed. The word honor here often involved financial support. It's a word that's also used of elders who were financially supported by the early churches. But he says the ones who are to be financially supported and helped by the congregation are to be those who are truly alone. Widows indeed is an expression that he would use here. Now remember, go back to Acts chapter 6. The church at Jerusalem had a ministry that took care of the widows. They fed the widows, kind of like our meals program for the widows they had at the church in Jerusalem. And likely that's what Paul is talking about, or something along those lines in this particular passage. Maybe not exactly, but it's something similar. But it's the idea of completely supporting and taking care of these widows. We're not talking about dropping by every once in a while when something is broken to fix it. We're not talking about dropping off a meal every now and then, but we're talking about a situation where they're completely supported by the church. The congregation becomes their means of survival on a daily basis. Now, he says the church should only take care of those who are widows indeed. And he basically says if they have family that is capable of taking care of them, then family needs to take care of them. And don't you notice what he says in verse 4? They must first learn to practice piety in regard to their own family and to make some return to their parents, for this is right in the sight of God. It seems to me a consistent Bible principle that God expects everybody to do their part. And that if we receive, we also give. And before we should expect to receive, we should give. And if we have been given, then we should give in return. In other words, he says, your parents took care of you. Now you take care of your parents. Now he doesn't just limit this to children, but it's an idea of family in general. The point is, family takes care of family. But especially should children and grandchildren show a return to take care of their parents and their grandparents. Down in verse 8, he says, if anyone does not provide for his own, in other words, if we don't take care of our family, especially those in our own household, then it's better than not to believe. We're worse than a person who doesn't believe. Now, folks, that's some pretty strong language. But apparently, it's some language that not all Christians have paid attention to. Because in my lifetime, I have known a lot of folks who had children who were supposed to be Christians, and they never took care of their parents. And I think Brother Carmack and Gary and Wendell and Brother Vaughn, we're so happy to have Brother Vaughn back. Glad he made it back safely from India. Rusty and others who've been out visiting, our elders who've been out visiting. My guess is all of these folks that I've mentioned and many of you have been in the nursing homes and you've been into the people's homes and you've been to hospitals to visit people who never see their kids. Okay, I don't think I'm letting a cat out of the bag, but it's there. When I go to the hospital and I see somebody passing away and I see the room filled with their children, one of the things I try to do periodically is just talk to the family about what a gift it is that you guys are all together. Because I've seen people die alone. I've seen people taking their last breath, not with a family who, you know, was there to care for them and love them and be there, but a family that was all wrapped up in their own world. And I know the families, you know, you couldn't even get them to show up to the funeral services. And so I want us to realize that what we're dealing with here and what Paul's talking about is not something that Christians are immune to. And he says that if a Christian doesn't take care of their family, he said they're worse than a person who doesn't even believe in God. In other words, I can go to all the worship services I want to. I can sing as many songs as I want. I can pray as often as I can. I can go on mission trips all over the world. I can give 30% of my means. But if I don't take care of family, and in this context, if I don't take care of aging members of my family, and specifically widows, none of that matters. Because he says, I'm worse than a person who doesn't believe. And so he says, I need to show a return to those who've taken care of me. All of us have benefited from those who've gone before us. This congregation exists because of those who've gone before us. And we live in a youth-infatuated society in which youth is now the end thing. And if we don't learn to return to a respect for age and experience, then we will take our society down with us. Does that mean we don't love and value our youth? Of course we need to love and value our youth. But I believe you learn about the quality of the society by how well they take care of their sick and their aged. And when they don't love and cherish their sick, their handicapped, and their aged, then that society is a low society, and in my opinion, is destined for destruction. The third thing he talks about is a reason for putting somebody on the list or not having them on the list. Think about the relevance of this. I mean, just this past week, I read an article that was in, I guess it was Fox News at their site, talking about when taking parents into your home and five things you need to think about before you take parents into your home. And of course, they weren't saying you shouldn't do that. They were just saying some legalities and just some things you need to consider and be prepared for everybody involved to work through that. I remember a few years ago in one of my graduate classes, they wanted us to do some census research on the family. In other words, they said, we want you to go to the U.S. Government Census Bureau site and look at what the new statistics are saying about families. And then we kind of got back together and said, what did we find? One of the things that we consistently noticed was the increase in multi-generational families. In other words, because people are living longer, we're seeing more and more generations that are living in one household. And so we're having, because of all these dynamics, the kind of things he's talking about are relevant, they're real, and they're things we're dealing with in our world. But what I want us to see before we move on is that while these dynamics are not always easy for everybody involved, the principle is very plain. We take care of each other. On the one hand, that means children and grandchildren taking care of parents. But it also, I think, means for the parents, there comes a point when the parent has to let the children do that when it becomes necessary. That's not an easy thing. I haven't walked that road and don't claim to have those answers. But Paul says, we take care of each other. But there are those who don't have anybody. There are those, as Paul describes, who are widows indeed, who do not have anybody to take care of them. And he says, for those in that category, the church can take care of them. But even not all of those are to be taken care of by the church. He says, only certain ones are to be put on the list. Now, the difficulty we have is, I've never seen the list. I don't know anybody who has ever seen the list. What is this list? What is he talking about? A lot of theories are out there. I think the simplest one is probably he's just talking about the list of widows who are completely financially supported by the congregation. Now, that's not 100%. I don't know for sure that's what it is. That's just my most educated guess. You can do some research on your own and see what you think. But basically, he says, go back up, for example, in verses 5, 6, and 7. It says, she's a widow indeed. She continues to put her trust in God, and she prays night and day. And what's interesting, we don't have time to do it today, but I would encourage you to take 1 Timothy chapter 5, verse 5, read it, then go to Luke chapter 2, verses 36 through 38, and read about the prophetess Anna. Okay, the wording is almost exactly the same. And it talks about both of them continuing in entreaties and prayers night and day. Remember, if you go to Anna, she's a woman who was 84 years old when Christ came to be dedicated at the temple. She had been married 7 years, and you remember, they usually married in their teens. So she'd been married 7 years, her husband had died, and so she had been a widow from sometime probably in her 20s till she's 84 now. And it says that she had devoted herself to service at the temple. In other words, she just basically lived at the temple and did whatever was needed to help folks at the temple. And that she devoted her life to praying for people, which is, I think, a pretty powerful and amazing thing. And so it's interesting then that he uses that kind of terminology to describe the kind of widows who ought to be helped by God's people. Now, in contrast to that, he talks about those widows who are kind of living it up in life. Those who are materialistic and self-centered, and for them, life is all about themselves. In fact, he not only talks about the seriousness of this, but I want you to notice his language. He says, those widows who are living in this kind of pleasure are dead even while they live. They are living life up, but they're dead spiritually, because they have not turned their hearts and lives over to God. But then he gets more specific and lays down some qualifications in verses 9 and 10. For example, they have to be at least 60 years of age. He says, husband of one wife. Literally, the word is you know, one man woman. Some believe that means she's only been married one time, and that is a possibility. I do not believe that's what he's talking about. I believe he's talking about marital faithfulness, that she's not had multiple husbands, not in a situation, for example, like in John chapter 4 and the woman at the well, who's been married five times and is now living with a man who is not her husband. Here's why I believe that it's talking about that kind of faithfulness and not being involved in polygamy rather than talking about the fact she's only been married one time. Because if that phrase means she could only have been married one time, you have a unique contrast and contradiction that sets up in this section. Because starting in verse 11, Paul's going to order those under the age of 60 to get married again. Okay, so he's going to order them to do something which is going to forever prohibit them after the age of 60 from ever having the opportunity to be helped by the church. Because remember, if this phrase means they couldn't be married twice, and he orders them to be married twice, then that means that if they're 61 years old and they don't have any children or family to take care of them, they happen to have been married twice, then they can't be helped by the church. And they're just left living on the streets and begging for life. In light of that, I do not believe that's what Paul's talking about, because he ends up disqualifying them by commanding them to do what he's asking them to do. The point we have to come back to, or I find myself struggling with, is, you know, why these qualifications? Why does he lay down these qualifications? It just doesn't make any sense. And it's interesting the similarities between these qualifications and some of the qualifications that are found back in chapter 3 in relations to elders and deacons and to deacons' wives. Here's my, again, educated guess twofold. One of the things we learn in the New Testament is that membership has its privileges. What I mean by that is we do have a responsibility to help all people. Galatians 6:10, do good unto all men, but especially those who are of the household of faith. So we have a responsibility to help everybody, but especially God's people. As God's people, we should expect some things from each other that the world should not expect from us. While I should help the whole world and everybody I have an opportunity to help, he says we especially help each other. But with that privilege comes responsibility. A responsibility of godliness and faithfulness and co-helping and co-working. I want you to remember a principle that Paul talked about in our last lesson on last Sunday morning. The principle of work. Do you remember what he said? He who does not work should not eat. So if you ask me why these qualifications is twofold. Number one, while we have membership privileges, we also have membership responsibilities of faithfulness. Remember earlier he's talked about those widows who lived very materialistic and self-centered lives. I can't live a life devoted to the devil and then ask God to financially support me. And so I think the first thing he's looking at is a godly lifestyle. A person who's lived their lives giving to other people. Who is the one the church should give to? The one who spent a lifetime of giving. The second reason I think he lays down these qualifications is that it is my opinion these widows offered service in the church, somewhat like Anna offered service in the temple. And I believe that based on trying to figure out why these qualifications are there, and based on the fact that Paul believed if you were going to eat, you worked. In other words, if the church was going to financially support these widows, I believe these widows helped in activities of the church. Maybe it was widows who played a vital role in the feeding of other widows under the oversight of some of the deacons. We already know from Titus chapter 3 and verse 4, it talks about older women and teaching the younger women. Maybe the widows played a vital role in the teaching of some of the women's classes. Maybe they were the ones who went from home to home and took care of sick members in their time of illness. Whatever it was, my gut reaction is that they served the congregation in some special way. And since they were going to be helping and serving within the congregation, Paul wanted to make sure that they were living godly lifestyles. We'll stop there for today, and we'll come back and look at what he's going to say in that next section. I remember back in the late 1970s, the Pittsburgh Pirates family team theme was "We Are Family." And they used to play that song blaring over the loudspeakers at their home games. You know, if we were going to play a theme song to describe us, that might well serve to be it. Because I think that's what Paul's saying. That's what he was saying this morning when we looked at 2 Thessalonians 3. That's what he was saying at the beginning of 1 Timothy 5 and throughout 1 Timothy 5. We're family. And family takes care of each other. That first of all, we need to take care of each other within our physical families. That means moms and dads, we need to work hard to provide for our children. But that also means children, when our parents grow older, we need to work hard to provide for them. But beyond that, not only are we to provide for each other in our physical families, but we provide for each other in our spiritual families. So why have an invitation after a sermon? Because folks can come anytime. If you want to make your life right with God, you can do it at 2 o'clock in the morning or 3 o'clock in the afternoon. You don't have to come forward in the service. There's no verse that says you have to make things right at the end of a service when the preacher says, "Y'all come." Why do we do it? One reason is we're family. And the family's not always together at 2 o'clock in the morning. But we're together now. And now that we're together, we can help each other with things that are even more important than the physical support Paul was talking about. We can help each other with spiritual matters. So what is it the family can help you with tonight? Would you like us to share in your being baptized into Christ for the forgiveness of your sins and rejoice in that with you? Would you like us to pray with you as you rededicate your heart and life to God? Would you like us to pray for some member of your family that's sick? We're family. Let us help as we stand and sing.